Hey, welcome everybody to Not So Famous Achievers. Weekly conversations with some of the world's most amazing but not so famous achievers on what they did and how they did it and what you can learn from their journey with your hosts, Will Crist and Robert White. Hey, guys.
Hello to everyone and welcome. We have a fascinating guest today. My longtime friend and I guess in some ways mentor, David Fine. Introducing David Fine is impossible because I either I'm going to say too little or too much. And so I'm going to have him kind of tell us in a specific kind of way to introduce himself. And Will, I think you're really going to enjoy this one.
Super.
Like, really.
I'm looking forward to it.
Look, David has a day job. He's the founder and CEO of a company called ValueSource. My understanding of that, which he can clarify, is that he provides software to CPAs, to financial advisors, to attorneys, to value closely held companies. How am I doing, David?
It's great. It's perfect.
All right. Now, he also has about a zillion interests. You know, I have an exercise that I sometimes do with executive mentoring clients, which I ask them for turning points in their life, you know, specific events that stand out to them. So, David, you took a long walk in a very cold place. You took a sailboat across an ocean. You started an incredible charity that's serving thousands and thousands of people every Christmas. You've been a great student in kind of my arena and personal growth. You've done a ton of things. So if you were introducing yourself, what are some of the things that you've done that I think most people just haven't done?
I've been very blessed. I have an interesting list of things I've been able to do. And I was thinking about it, you know, coming on the show. I think one of the first things that happened to me that really had an impact on my life was my mother was divorced. I was 10 years old, and she decided to move to Spain with us for a year, just my sister and I. And I didn't realize then, but I realize now what a gutsy thing for a single mom to do. And it really opened my eyes to so much, like the whole world travel. I think we get stuck in America, you know, our perspective geographically, psychologically, all that stuff. And so she was a teacher, and so she homeschooled us. And I don't know if you know, are you familiar with the Alhambra in Granada? It's a magnificent Moorish Castle. I don't know if you've ever seen. Incredible. Google it. It's an amazing place. I used to do homeschool there a couple days a week when I was 10 years old. So, you know, that was something that just had a gigantic impact on my life. That was, you know, the first, I would say, incident or event in my life that really had a giant impact. The next one, you mentioned my cold place walking. The next one was, you know, going to the South Pole when I was 16 years old. And when I was a sea cadet when I was 15, and I got the opportunity to go on an icebreaker for 6 months, which was a miraculous, incredible thing for a kid. I got to get out of high school for 6 months, which I think was half the reason I decided to go. But, you know, that whole adventure, you know, putting that together, it wasn't just, you know, the trip was sort of planned. And I sort of, you know, showed up and it happened. Part of it was that way. You know, the trip was 25,000 miles, Hawaii, Australia, New Zealand, Antarctica, Ushuaia, up the coast of South America. But at that point, I'd been reading a lot about the early polar explorers, and they were fascinating to me. People like Amundsen and Byrd and Shackleton, especially, you know, in the early 1900s, they were fighting to be the first person at the South Pole. So, you know, these guys sort of captured my imagination and created a dream. You know, the ship was going to the edge of the south of Antarctica, but that was like 800 miles away from the pole. So I wanted to find a way to get my butt to the South Pole. So in working with my father, we came up with the South Pole project. It was really my first, I would say, entrepreneurial sort of adventure, you know, creating something that was way beyond my grasp, way beyond my reach, something that had a bit of magic to it. And so I ended up flying a U.S. flag at the South Pole to give to President Carter. And, you know, we convinced the Coast Guard and the Sea Cadets and the Navy that it was worth risking my life to send me to the South Pole. So that was my first entrepreneurial adventure, I think.
And you got there?
Yes, I got there. I was 16 years old. It was January 14th, 1977. And I flew a flag at the South Pole. It was 60 below zero. And I had absolutely the wrong clothing. If you have ever seen movies and videos about those guys that explore down there, they've got these giant red jackets with these big fur things and these big boots and these gloves and these huge hats, right? I was in like a gardening jacket and some leather gloves, you know? So it was actually a bit dangerous, but luckily I was only there for about 30 minutes. And so, yeah, it's interesting. I remember the moment, you know, I stepped off the plane on the South Pole and it's like something happened. You know, I had this crazy dream at 15 to go to Antarctica. And then I developed this, you know, bigger dream to get to the South Pole. And there I stood. I mean, you know, it was one of those moments that I think shifted my whole psychology, my whole belief about what's possible, and my whole belief about going for things that, you really have some heartfelt desire to do, but you may think is a stretch or impossible.
Yeah. One of my mentors says, thoughts become things.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Thoughts become things. And I sometimes get disappointed when we believe that there's something out there that we cannot do or some social issue that we cannot solve, when that's not true. We are created to solve.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
I think you can make an argument that we're created to create.
Yes, absolutely. But
that's maybe a longer discussion.
Well, absolutely. The creation is the creation of the new solution. That's the entrepreneurial quest, to create new value for a given set of products, services, or circumstances.
So my relationship with David, so if I can come clean here, is that he graduated from the LifeSpring training, a company I founded many years ago and then later sold. And so we have that piece in common. But as I've gotten to know him personally and as a dear friend, part of my admiration for David and his lovely wife is that they launched something that's now called the Christmas Tree Project. And I know that many of my clients, executive clients, are looking for a way to express themselves away from work, to use those talents that they've developed over the years in building their company or in creating their company, but to use it for a greater good. And David's an example of that. And a couple of years ago, I was thinking about, I'm wanting to support them beyond donating some things, and we'll tell you more about that in a moment, but and some money, is I thought I would help with publicity. So I wrote a press release, and I submitted it to cable television. And so I don't remember the exact wording, but here goes something close. A Jewish guy with a Hindu wife and a Buddhist sister have created the Christmas Tree Project to help Christians celebrate Christmas.
Nice.
David, I mean, you've done amazing things with it, but just for our audience, just do an overview of what's happened the last few years. How many families have you served and what are you really up to?
For sure. Well, I think the story how it got started is also, to me, impactful. We gave away our own Christmas tree 10 years ago because we bought a new one. And we just put a one-line ad on Craigslist that said, free Christmas tree to a family with kids. And we got 20 responses in an hour. I'll never forget them. And they were touching, you know, single moms, wounded vets, boys' homes, people that were struggling with all sorts of issues. And it really touched us. So we found a family to give our tree away to. And my wife had $20 from her principal to do something good with. And she said, why don't we take that 20 and pitch in the rest and buy the boys' home a tree? And she said, and I'll never forget this. She said, but we can't just buy a tree. We have to buy the ornaments and the lights and tinsels and candy canes and all that stuff. So I said, sure. So, you know, back to Home Depot to buy another tree. And we showed up at the boys' home. And I never even realized there were boys and girls' home, dozens of them in Colorado Springs that have, you know, sort of institutionalized foster care, court ordered, you know, out of home. I never thought about that. You know, how many kids are not living in their home because of one reason or another? And so we showed up and I thought, you know, these are sort of rough and tumble kids in the system, court ordered. I mean, do they really even care about a Christmas tree? Well, it turns out they deeply cared about a Christmas tree because it meant so many things. The symbol of a tree meant family. It meant normalcy. It meant you know, having people that cared about you, all those things that we associate with holidays and Christmas. So they were deeply touched, and so were we. So we were having dinner with some friends, and we told them the story, and we'd given away two trees. So we half jokingly said, we have 18 left.
And yay!
They started, you know, literally at the dinner table, bringing out their wallets and throwing 20 bucks on the table, right? So
yeah.
We collected the few bucks that we got, and we bought, I don't remember, was three more trees and gave it to, I remember this one wounded vet who's a single dad with a couple of kids. And then the Gazette, the local paper down here, ran a story. I think it was December like 12th. And they had a picture of the boys' home tree, and they had a little story about what we were doing. So that was December 12th. By December 22nd, 10 days later in Colorado Springs, we had given away 300 Christmas trees.
Yay!
So it was crazy. I mean, it was crazy. And, you know, we realized we really had something that touched people, that made a difference, the community in Colorado Springs. The truth is, Michelle and I, you know, gave away two trees, our friends gave away another couple, and the community gave away the other 290 something, right? So it was a community thing, you know, community helping community. And what was so interesting too is it was sort of after the financial crisis, you know, people were struggling. I hadn't seen those people eye to eye. You know, you hear about them, you read about them, but in your normal day-to-day travels, you don't see them eye to eye. So that had a gigantic impact on me and also everybody else involved. You know, the symbol of handing someone a Christmas tree, we learned, means so much. So anyway, you know, it kept growing and growing. And Robert has been an incredible elf for all these years, donating his time, talent, energy, and support and love. And so we've given away over 4,000 Christmas trees around the country and around the world. Karachi, we gave away one, Sri Lanka, Nairobi, Warsaw. We're working on the international piece. That's a little more complicated. But, you know, our goal is to create a bit of Christmas magic in as many lives as we can. CBS National News sent out a couple of producers from New York a few years ago, and they did a national story on us, which exploded the thing nationally. Yeah. So it's been a great adventure. And this year, I'm so excited to announce Yellowtail Wine is doing a national sponsorship of the Christmas Tree Project. And right. They're going to help us be in every city in the United States.
Right. Wonderful. You know how important that is. The two pieces that I pick up on that. Number one is how significant some of these things that we take for granted, like putting up a Christmas tree. My wife works she's the head of an outreach center in Riverside, California. And this is for homeless people out just coming out of prison, out of job, all these kind of difficult places. Well, there was a Thursday evening feeding. They have a meal, right? And she set it up so they're cooking for each other. It's not somebody swooping in, doing it, and leaving. These were people who were cooking for each other, and a couple of hundred people. She discovered that in the midst of all of the food that had been given from grocery stores and various places, there's a lot of kind of big, beautiful cakes. So she said, you know, maybe we should have some birthday celebrations. So once a month, they got together, they figured out who was, and so they had a birthday cake and four, five, six people birthday. And she discovered that there were people in that group who had never, ever had their birthday celebrated. And how significant that is, because that's one of the ways that we tell people we see you, we celebrate you. She just had all these people crying because never had they experienced that. And what I pick up from you is also when you're doing that, you are normalizing that person and you are seeing them and experiencing them, which means they feel seen and experienced. And that changes their world. It probably changed your world too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. When you tell that story about the birthday cake, I remember a woman, I can clearly see her. I don't remember her name. She had 10 children. It was a few years ago. And this was the first Christmas tree that family ever had. Right? Yeah, it was amazing. There's so many stories. It's touching on both sides. And what I've heard so many times is that, you know, the tree is important. They're so grateful for the tree. And remember, they don't just get a tree. They come here and they get a tree and they get decorations and they get lights and tinsel and candy. And they walk out with bags full of stuff to decorate their homes too. You should see downstairs. I've got six rooms packed floor to ceiling, wall to wall with Christmas stuff. But people, what they say is that stuff is really fabulous and they appreciate it. But what really touches them is that they know, like you said, they are seen and that they recognize that people care about them. And that that has made a huge difference.
Yeah. And what's so powerful about that is you don't have to be a millionaire to do that. You don't even have to have a job to do that. I mean, we can do that for each other when we were ready to do that. And that, to me, that experience is like jumping into a swimming pool. It's totally immersive and it will change your life.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember a story. There's a woman, she came, she'd recently been out of prison and she came to get a tree. She hadn't had a tree in years. She was in prison. And once she saw what was going on, she says, "I don't want a tree. I want to help." And she spent the entire day helping. And the look on her face, you know, the gratefulness in her face and heart and tears in her eyes to spend a day giving back. It was, you know, amazing. It was amazing.
You know, to pull this off, David, I'm aware that there are literally hundreds of elves, hundreds of people that donate time and energy and talent to helping you do this. And one of the things that I realized is that you got all these guys with pickup trucks that deliver trees, right? Well, you know, I think I've never seen a survey, but I think there are a lot of people that buy a pickup truck and nothing ever goes into the bed of the pickup. and yet they get the opportunity to actually use their truck and that incredible benefit of dropping off a fully decorated tree for people. What a treat. And the other thing is that what you're doing with cash donations, which is the day after Christmas, you go shopping, you know, for the 50-70% off.
And that, right.
And then you've got, you know, you've somehow created and enrolled this incredible landlord in your office building to donate all of that space. I mean, David and I enjoy, I think probably about once a month, we enjoy sushi together. And this time I got a tour of the Christmas Tree Project, which is now has an official labeling on the building, by the way.
Nice.
I mean, this incredible landlord, but I got to look through the six rooms, which are kind of organized on themes, but they're jammed floor to ceiling, barely a little bit of walk space in each one of things that were either donated by people who were maybe downsizing their home, which is what started out for me, but also that those December 26th shopping trips. It's an amazing project. And, you know, our audience, David, are people like you, people that are running a company or in mid-level managers, people like that, men and women that I think are ambitious, that are looking for ideas about achievement. One of the things in your background is that you built your company and then sold it and then somehow bought it back. Can you talk about that progress as a businessman?
Sure. Well, it was an interesting story. I just got back from sailing from Tahiti when I was working for my first actual job out of college. They ended up firing everybody and giving a 6-month severance pay. A few weeks later, I used to run a charter boat business. The woman whose boat it was called me and said, "We're sailing to Tahiti. Do you want to come?" And I said, "Of course, I'm kidding. It's a lifelong dream." But when I got back, you know, I was sort of, you know, struggling. You know, I didn't really want another corporate job. And I was helping a guy start a computer company. He was actually the first Michael Dell before Michael Dell, selling sub $1,000 computers sort of out of the back of his truck in flea markets. They didn't exist. It was before Dell came out. And so a guy walked into that shop and said, "I've got a computer. I'm desperate. I'm a business guy. And this thing's broken." I said, "Come back in a week when we're open." He said, "You don't understand. I need this today." I go, "Okay. You know, you look desperate. I'll see what I can do." And I'll never forget. He walks out the door, closes the door, and then he comes back in, opens the door and pokes his head in. He says, "I've got this software company. I need a programmer. Do you know a programmer?" Just weird. Like, why did he come back? "I'm a programmer. That was my training." And so I said, "I'm a programmer." And that's really how ValueSource started. It was in early 1986. And Craig and I, he was the financial you know, wizard. He was the business valuation guy. He actually had all the business experience. I had very little at that point. And so ValueSource had just started, and we worked together sort of shoulder to shoulder, literally writing code. It was before there was big sophisticated systems to write code. We had to do it, you know, in a very primitive way. So we grew it and grew it and grew it and, you know, sort of pick and shovel it and, you know, got it to a place where we needed to do something with it. It needed a transition. We needed a partner. You know, we needed someone to buy us. And so we met a guy. He's actually in Denver. His name is Rob Gettinger. And I'll never forget, he came to us and said, I think I can help you either find a partner or sell it. So it was at the time where the computer industry was exploding and the publishing industry was struggling to get their arms around how is IT tech software going to impact publishing. So John Wiley and Sons bought us in, was it 1994? And so we moved to Colorado Springs. Their office building in Manhattan was completely packed. So we moved here, and I worked as their head of software, you know, for about a decade. And they're a great company. I mean, I have to say, I really appreciated their culture. You know, when I started with them, they were about $500 million. By the time I bought it back, they were about $1 billion. So they'd grown substantially. But they were a book publishing company. And, you know, I remember... you know, one example I use is we wanted to do something, hand out something different when people bought our software, some kind of an add-in or another flyer or something. And, you know, somebody came back to me and said, you realize, you know, the Wiley warehouse sends out $1 million a day in books. They're shipping $1 million a day in books. So for you ask for a change in the process down there, you have to understand, you know, that's like not going to happen, you know? So, you know, there were some good things and there were some struggles because they were a book company. At one point, we both realized it'd be better for me to buy it back. So in 2004, I bought ValueSource back and have been running it as a standalone software company ever since.
So now, they bought ValueSource and used the software for what was intended for?
Well, I mean, did they use it to buy us? No. In other words,
no. But I mean, did Wiley open up a business valuation arm or something with the software?
Well, keep in mind, they had a they've got, you know, Wiley is got a lot of books in a lot of different areas. They had a lot of professional books. They had a lot of business books, and they thought it would go along well with their professional books. So, what they did is they kept us as a sort of a intact entity, and we produced software and sold it, you know, with their help. I mean, some things were really helpful. Like, you know, they would send out catalogs to a lot of people and we would put software in the catalogs and get a lot more exposure. So ValueSource continued to grow as a business valuation software company within Wiley for 10 years.
And they also bought a number of training companies. Well,
So this was really for them was a profit play.
Both. I mean, I think they're bigger thing than just straight number. I mean, obviously they're buying it from an economic ROI perspective, but right. I think even more important to them was to get their hands on, you know, software companies, software entities, and, you know, learn how they breathe, think, function, right? Because they realized that you know, software was going to impact publishing. I don't think they realized how much at that point. I mean, now it's obvious with Amazon and all the other kinds of things. But yeah, they wanted to be involved with it. So there was a number of software companies they bought. And like Robert said, they bought some training companies. They also bought some leadership analysis companies. That one actually was, I think, a closer fit than the software company, because developing software is a very different animal than developing, obviously, you know, print products.
Right. Excellent. Well, I think it's, I hope you'll stick around because we got a lot more conversation to go, and let's take a little break here and let's hear from our sponsors.
Well, we're going to give you one quick thought here that plays into what we've been talking about here today. Our two hosts have lived extraordinary lives and been extraordinary entrepreneurs, and Robert White, certainly one of them. He mentors extraordinary entrepreneurs and executives just like you, people who want better results from their leadership performance. He shows them how to turn those results into increased personal joy and satisfaction as well. Robert founded and led two large training industry success stories. He's been there and done that, and his experience will help you find and achieve that extraordinary success you seek in your life. So why wait? Reach out and see what Robert can do for you today. Just email him at robert@extraordinarypeople.com, robert@extraordinarypeople.com, and start living the extraordinary life you've earned.
Does your company have a clear vision? Do you have the right people in the right seats? Are you consistently getting the results you want and enjoying the journey? If not, consider EOS, the Entrepreneurial Operating System. EOS is a set of simple concepts and practical tools used by more than 100,000 companies around the world to clarify, simplify, and achieve their vision. Schedule your free 90-minute meeting with an EOS implementer at EOSworldwide.com today. That's EOSworldwide.com.
And now back to our show.
Well, here we are. Looks like Robert has turned off his camera, but he'll be back shortly. So, David, tell me, what, in addition to the Christmas tree project, what are you most excited about for the next 6 months?
Well, I guess there's two pieces to that. At ValueSource, we've been developing valuation software products, obviously, for a long time. One of the things that we developed early on, valuation software really conceptually is pretty simple. You know, think of a spreadsheet. There's a bunch of numbers. There's a bunch of data that goes into that. And then you need to create a report on the back end. And business valuation reports are complex. So we've developed report writers that automate that whole process. But it's only been done in the context of our software and our platform. So about a year ago, we created a standalone report writer. So imagine anybody that's doing a lot of number crunching, but needs to communicate that in a Word document to create some kind of report around. So we have a new product that we call the Zap Report Writer, which automates, you know, that whole process. So I'm really excited about that. We have an online business valuation application, which helps business owners value their own business online, or financial professionals help their clients do that. Business value is one of those things that most business owners don't understand.
Yeah, right. Oh, billions of dollars. Billions.
Yeah. Well, here's what I figured. Here's what I figured out. Most business owners do. They go, how much money do I need and want? And how much money do I owe? You add those together, and that's what the business is worth. I mean, you know, all the time. So so we have a program.
Or how much does my wife want me to be able to bring in every year?
Yeah. But it's a sad thing. You know, we've worked in the valuation business. We've been in and around the brokerage business, the M&A business. And the truth is 80% of businesses in the United States are not sellable. In other words, there's no value there. They can't sell them. So, you know, and for a lot of those people, they really, you know, didn't understand value to begin with. You know, they're not strategic kind of thinkers. They're, you know, it's sort of like the E-Myth thing. People get into business because they know some specific thing, you know, it sort of, you know, grabs their life, and they never take the time to either get the help, get the coaching, or learn about what does strategic thinking mean in business. And the impact on value is gigantic.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I just got through, I was telling Robert, I just got through deciding I didn't want to rent a session space for $5,000 a month for a 5-year lease. That's $300,000. But it makes a lot more sense to find something to buy, because now I've got an ongoing value.
Yeah. Yeah. Strategic thinking in business, it's one of those things that I came very late to the game in. And that was an interesting story, too. We had a client, and it's so typical, right? You have a client that is got a big percentage of your revenue and profit, and you're really not diversified enough, and you really don't spend enough energy, you know, making that happen. And then they leave, and then it's like a, you know, a kick in the chest. And, you know, that's when you learn about strategy and making things happen. So that's what happened to us. You know, I learned, you know, as a programmer, you know, coming into it. So that was easy. I figured I better learn marketing and sales, or my kids are going to starve to death. And so that one was relatively easy. And then the other kinds of things came along, but the strategy and execution piece, that sort of high level thinking rather than the day-to-day firefighting thinking, which I think so many of us get into.
Yeah. I call that blood on the floor or fire in the hall.
Yep.
And,
yeah.
If you're the business owner and you're struggling with that, you're in the wrong, doing the wrong thing.
Definitely.
All right. So here's a question for you. Yeah. And we can make this very quiet so that nobody really knows. But what are you thinking about in terms of the coming tsunami of artificial intelligence?
Well, that's an interesting question. We're starting to put bits and pieces of that into our software. About 3 years ago, I bought a Vive virtual reality set for my house. And I don't know, have you played with those high-end virtual reality sets?
No.
You must. Both Robert, have you? I don't know if you have. To me, it's a must. For thinkers like you and thought leaders like you, it's a must. Not just because it's an absolutely incredible experience, which it is. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've been sitting in my living room, literally saying, wow, I'm on top of Mount Everest. Wow. Face to face with a blue whale. But I think, you know, the whole thing with virtual reality, artificial, you know, augmented reality and artificial intelligence is going to be, it will be a tsunami. It will change the world tremendously. And I think virtual reality and augmented reality, along with AI, will bring things that we can't even imagine. Very soon here. You know, it's interesting. I do some volunteer work in prisons, and they have AI and VR in prisons to teach welding, right? Mm-hmm. There's a million examples of it. It was very cool. I have a friend that's a football guy, and he knows the guy who started, he was the ex-manager for the Broncos, and they started a company to do virtual reality quarterback training. And their office happens to be in downtown Colorado Springs. So I was invited in, and I got to put on the headset and be a quarterback. And you know what I mean? It's like, you know, it's a combination of AI and VR. It's just, I'm super excited about it. If I could work in the VR world and AI world, I would.
So, did you say you had a particular kind of VR headset that you were?
Yeah, it's a Vive. Using? I mean, it's you know, Vive is a brand. It's the one, you know, it's a higher end headset. But it really, you know, I think the world. I think the other thing that's going to change dramatically too is if you look at. You know, the emotional state of the world today with COVID, I think it's been impacted hugely. I do some work with vets too and wounded vets. And, you know, if you look at that whole situation, it's you know, super challenging, pretty traumatic for them, certainly. I think when you start, you know, we're not there yet, but I think what we're going to see is a combination of AI and VR and AR in relationship to, you know, emotions, psychology, state management, from the whole spectrum of things. They're doing some fabulous work with virtual reality and wounded vets. I don't know if you've seen it. Have you heard about it?
No, tell me.
Yeah, super excited. You know, what they're finding is, you know, you know, what I learned in LifeSpring was, you know, our emotional state is everything, right? And you know, those of us that didn't grow up in traumatic, you know, households really don't understand the impact of emotions on the subtle things that happen in our life that create a giant impact, right? So, you know, with vets, what they're doing is, you know, they've been through so many things, you know, psychology, coaching, therapy, all that stuff. And it, you know, it's certainly helpful, but it doesn't crack the nut. So what they're doing with virtual reality is they're putting people back in those scenes, right? You know, they're putting them back in those kind of things and helping them relive them and then coaching them through that, right? Because the trick is, if it's bottled up, you know, it creates, you know, a literal hell in your life. But if you can find a way to release it, you know, that becomes the trick. And with virtual reality, you know, you read the stories, you get chills. You know, they go back there in virtual reality, they can taste it, they can smell it. Now, the smell and the taste is not provided by virtual reality, but in their own mind, they've recreated this stuff, and it helps them. It helps them, you know, move beyond it. The success rate is amazing. I mean, it's powerful stuff.
Well, you know, go ahead, Robert.
Well, we're, you know, drawing kind of close to the end of this thing, and there's an expression that occurred to me recently. It's an old expression, which is from Will Rogers, the newsman who was really a comedian, who was really a social justice warrior in his own way. Mm-hmm. He said that never ask a barber if you need a haircut. And, you know, one of the things that brings Will and I together, David, is that we work with executives who are either in some kind of trouble. You know, they're losing key people, or their market share, or their profits are under pressure, or maybe they're not sleeping so well at night because of some problem, or they've got a really big dream and they're kind of clear that they're going to need some help to accomplish that dream. And we work in different areas. I work more on mindset. Will works more on operations and really having systems and that people in the right seat and all of those things that are vital to the success of a company. You know, we came together because of your attending LifeSpring and being very grateful about that experience. Could you share, you know, you were already a successful guy. Why did you go to LifeSpring? What happened for you as a result of that personal growth experience.
Yeah, sure. It's probably not an uncommon story for men in personal growth workshops. I went because my girlfriend, now my wife, and now that's a funny story. We hadn't known each other that long. And she was staffing. She had been through the training and had been staffing, and she was very passionate about it. It made a gigantic difference in her life. And so one morning, it was like a Saturday morning, you know, she said, I need to go staff this training. Do you want to come? That's all I heard. That was it. Right. So I showed up at the 3-day with that. I didn't even realize it was an overnight thing. I didn't even bring any clothes. It was like ridiculous. So that's why I showed up. But the impact was, and I've told you this, Robert, I mean, it's probably the most significant thing that I look to, you know, my personal growth, understand more than understanding. I remember, you know, maybe the way to explain it is I remember walking out of the 3-day feeling like a different human being. You know what I mean? The world looked different to me because I was so different. And, you know, like I said, I didn't grow up in a traumatic, you know, quote, traumatic childhood with all the craziness that so many people unfortunately can go through. But there were issues, right? I mean, there were divorces. There were all sorts of, you know, subtle things that I developed core beliefs about, defense mechanisms about, masks about, patterns about, which I wasn't really aware of. And the thing that really was shocking to me is how much of an emotional hold they had on me, which I didn't even realize. So for me, that was absolutely transformational. I ended up doing the 5-day, it literally changed my life in 7 days. I'm not kidding. I'm not underestimating it. And Robert, I'll publicly thank you again for, you know, your work and putting that together. The impact it had on me was incredible. And what I ended up doing, the guy that was the trainer, I felt like a kindred spirit with. He felt like a brother to me. And I ended up going on sabbatical at ValueSource for, it was at least a year. And I worked with him putting on trainings. I love the work. And I, you know, I thought my destiny was to work with him to go around the world to do that kind of work. And he died young, and I came to Colorado, and that was the end of that.
So Robert, where do people find that kind of experience today?
Well, there are spinoffs of LifeSpring in many major cities. If they contact me and tell me where they're from, I'll see if I can connect them to that experience, a local experience. But it's also, frankly, worth traveling for. But robert@extraordinarypeople.com, and I'm happy to deal with those requests, because I still feel that experience, even when I'm not personally involved in the company, there are many people doing really good work. Just like you've got that network of EOS implementers, you can refer people instantly and know that they're going to get very high quality performance from that local person. I've got the same situation. And David, how about you? If people want to get in touch with you, either because they're interested in business software, valuation software, or they're interested in the Christmas Tree Project, how do you guide them? How can we help you connect to the people that are interested in your work?
Sure. My email, you know, dfine@valuesource.com, no E at the end of value, or just, you know, call myself, 719-337-3257. If you want to be an elf, we need elves all over the world. So wherever you are, if you're listening, if you feel like you'd be an elf, I promise it'll be a powerful experience. I'd love to talk to you.
You know, I think there are a lot of people that have an attic or a storage unit or a basement full of Christmas decorations that they're no longer using because they've downsized or because they've changed their decorating or for whatever reason. And So if they contact you, they can send that stuff to you, and it's going to be used this year, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I promise, you know, the impact it has on people is beyond what you can imagine. When you hand, and most of these families too, I mean, we give, you know, trees to, you know, lots of different kind of people, but a majority of them are, you know, younger families with kids. And, you know, when you think about the symbolism of Christmas and providing for your family, I've heard that again and again and again, when you can't do that, it is just painful. So when you can help them create some Christmas magic for their children, the impact is huge. It, you know, in some cases it does change their life.
Well, and it feels so good to know that stuff that's been in storage is being used and putting delight on children's faces.
Right?
I'm speaking personally. You know, I donated one of the things I had. You know, I had a very large home, and we collected these little village houses and things so you could do a Christmas village. And I donated it to David. What I didn't know is they kept it. I mean, you can tell the story, David. They kept it for a long time.
Well, it was so beautiful. You know, we get some amazing stuff, but some stuff is like over the top amazing. And as soon as it comes in the door, when I see something like that, I put it aside because it needs to go to a special person. And when you donated that I think it was a German Christmas village, if I remember right,
yes.
I immediately knew that there was no way I was just going to put it out. So it sat in my office for probably 2 years. And I remember the guy that came. He just got back from Iraq. He got hit with an IED. He was a mess. He'd been through all sorts of struggles. His wife had cancer, I think. She was German. They had a couple of kids in a house. And the Army had screwed up his transition from active service to whatever he was going to. And he had no money. He couldn't buy food. He couldn't pay the mortgage on the house. They were, you know, struggling at every single level. And I remember him walking up the stairs. He was struggling walking up the stairs. He was like physically in pain. He was wounded, right? And his wife was German. Soon as I saw him, I knew that village was going to. And so I told him, and I told his wife, I said, I think I have something I think you'll like. And I'll never forget the tears streaming down her face when she saw it.
Yeah.
Well, look, I encourage people, and if you don't have an attic full of stuff, send the Christmas Tree Project some money. They use it very, very well.
That's right.
David, David, how would you like to wrap up today? I hope this was something that you enjoyed and found value in, but what do you have to say before we sign off today?
Sure. Well, one, it's a pleasure to be with you guys, Robert. It's always a pleasure. I guess for me that, you know, I think the thing I've learned the most in the last 10 years is the thing, and you hear this all the time, is that giving back and making a difference will really make the biggest difference in our own lives. And I found that to be absolutely true in all the pieces. You know, being an ELF is my most honored title. You know, that helps. I'm involved in, you know, 7 Habits for Incarcerated Vets. You know, I'm involved in doing a prison program, you know, with Lessons from the Stage Behind Bars. I would just encourage everybody. We're all too busy. None of us have enough time. I think I'm very grateful that some of that stuff just dropped in my lap. But I would, you know, encourage people to find a way to give back and engage your heart in the world. And the other thing I found, too, is that Value Source is ELF Central. And having that much heartfelt energy in the company has been magical. It's really made a giant difference, you know, not just the people getting Christmas trees, but every single person that works here. So that would be my message. Find a way to give back. Figure it out. Schedule it. You know, you'll never have enough time. You'll never have enough money. You'll never. So just, you know, just do it. And find something that scares you a little bit, too. Don't do something that's too safe, like writing a check to, you know, some company that, you know, that's great. I appreciate that. But find something that, you know, really challenges you, excites you, and scares you a little bit.
How about if you run out of things, take a flag to South to Antarctica, right? The South Pole.
Right.
Great to meet you, David. Wonderful.
You too.
Will, can you wrap things up for us?
Absolutely. I mean, to me, what we keep discovering is that people rediscover what we forget so often, that while we have gifts to build, we also have gifts to share, and it's when we get to that place where we've built a wonderful business, a wonderful home, a wonderful life, that then we can turn and not give to somebody who is less than us, but we really rediscover that they are just like us. And maybe in a different context, a different environment, a different set of traumas, a different set of experiences. But when we look them in the eye and listen to what they need, and from our resources can help share, it not only changes their lives, it changes ours, and it changes the world. And David, you are a world changer.
Thank you.
David, thank you. Thank you again for being with us. Thank you for sharing so much of you. I know it's almost second nature to you to do that. And I admire you greatly. I love you. And and I always look forward to the next time we meet.
Absolutely. Hopefully it's soon.
And I will too.
I'd love to meet you too.
Take care.
Well, there you have it. Some more conversations with maybe some not so famous achievers. But sure, they are big believers in changing the world. Right here in Orange County's only community radio station, octalkradio.net. Streaming live from the University of California, Irvine's Beal Applied Innovation Center.